Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Let's learn about our world and practice our American English skills. We begin today with a trip to France. Recent terrorist attacks in Paris have increased tensions between French citizens and immigrants. The Anti-Immigration National Front Party says the attacks prove what it has been warning about, that France is being attacked by radical Islamists. Party leaders say France must stop letting people from other countries immigrate. Alain Ba does not oppose immigration. His own wife is from Cuba. He believes European immigrants have made France a better country. But he says the most recent immigrants are hurting the country's economy and threatening its stability. Mr. Ba lives in Bagnolet, a town separated from Paris by only a busy road. Communists controlled the town for many years. Now socialists do. Mr. Ba supports the National Front. He believes Islam threatens France. And he says, increasingly, so do his friends.
They tell me, if we are not reacting between few years, it will be a civil war in France.
The National Front believes as Mr. Ba does. After the attacks in January, the party printed a poster that shows jihadist fighters and the map of France with the words, Islamist peril, let's protect the French.
Ils ont tous des propositions pour lutter contre ce terrorisme islamiste radical.
National Front leader Marine Le Pen says that the party has been warning about the dangers of Islamist fundamentalism for years. Even today, she says, politicians do not offer what she believes are the correct solutions. End immigration and close the country's borders. The Front was founded in the 1970s. Few voters have supported it since its founding, and its members have had little success in campaigns for political office. But that has been changing recently. Last May, it received 25% of the votes in European Union elections. Still, few French people will publicly admit that they support the party. Even after the attacks, the Front stayed apart from other political parties. Its leaders did not join a huge march in Paris that followed the attacks. Its members gathered separately in another place. Support for the country's unpopular president, François Hollande, has doubled since the attack. But political experts say that support will soon return to its low level. They believe that as time passes, more people will ask questions about security and radical Islam. Sociologist Michel Viviorca says that is when voters will decide to support the Front's strong security and anti-immigration message.
People will say the left is unable to change. The right was unable to change. Let us try something else. Let us try Marine Le Pen.
The country's economic condition is still poor, and many people are jobless. The ruling Socialist Party has struggled to answer the concerns of the French people. And public opinion studies show the Front is gaining support. A new study shows Ms. Le Pen would win the first round of presidential elections in 2017 if they were held today, but would lose in the second. The Front even seems to be gaining support in towns like Bagnolet, which have high numbers of immigrants. Hervé Atlan is a pharmacist in the town. He is also worried about how his country is changing. He says he bought food at the grocery store in Paris that was attacked last month by an Islamist. His children attend a Jewish school nearby. Mr. Atlan says the government promises to protect Jews like himself, but does not take action. But he says the National Front is not the solution. He says in the past, the front was considered anti-Semitic, although Marine Le Pen has sought the votes of Jews in recent years. Wahid Tamin and Tahar Azula are French Muslims. They were born here. Their parents came from North Africa. They are looking for work. They say it is hard to find a job, and their Muslim names make it harder. Mr. Tamin says he does not support any political party, but he might vote for Marine Le Pen. He says she supports people with blonde hair and blue eyes. But he says we support her for saying what she believes and for not lying about her beliefs. The Front's message will be tested next month when local elections take place. A recent public opinion study showed 26% of expected voters would support the party. Mr. Barr says he is sure the Front will get many votes in Bagnolet because the French people want change. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington, and this is the Voice of America. Frank Lloyd Wright is often called the father of American modern architecture. He designed buildings and homes across the United States for more than 70 years. This month, the United States nominated 10 of his buildings for the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization World Heritage List. The list recognizes the most important cultural and natural sites worldwide. Ashley Thompson tells us more.
The 10 properties included in the United States proposal, titled Key Works of Modern Architecture by Frank Lloyd Wright, were built between 1906 and 1969. They include several of his personal homes and studios, churches, government buildings, private residences, and one very famous museum, New York City's Guggenheim Museum. The Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum is one of the most visited sites in New York City. About 1 million people visit every year. Frank Lloyd Wright worked on it from 1943 to 1959. It was designed to create a new type of space for new types of art. The museum remains an international icon of modern architecture that represents Wright's unique design. Many of Mr. Wright's modern buildings and homes in the U.S. Midwest have also become icons of modern American architecture. In the early 1900s, Frank Lloyd Wright designed what are often called prairie houses. A prairie is a large, mostly flat area of land with few trees and covered in grass. One of Mr. Wright's most famous prairie houses, the Roby House, is also included among the 10 buildings. The Roby House, located in Chicago, Illinois, looks like a series of long, low rooms on different levels. The rooms seem to float over the ground. Mr. Wright designed everything in this house, including the furniture and floor coverings. Mr. Wright's prairie houses had a great influence on home design in America. Richard Longstretch is the president of the Frank Lloyd Wright Building Conservancy. He calls Mr. Wright the father of modern architecture, fundamentally redefining the nature of form and space during the early 20th century, that would have enduring impacts on modern architecture worldwide. The UNESCO World Heritage Committee will announce its decision in mid-2016. If Frank Lloyd Wright's 10 buildings are chosen for the list, they would be the first World Heritage listings for modern U.S. architecture. The World Heritage List already includes 22 other American sites, including the Grand Canyon, Yellowstone National Park, and the Statue of Liberty. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Jim Tedder. This is VOA.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. About 500 American companies operating in China say they are making a profit. But top-level officials with the companies say they increasingly feel unwelcome and targeted by the Chinese government. The American Chamber of Commerce in China released the results of a survey of its members earlier this week. 57% of top-level managers said they feel Chinese officials are concerned about investigating foreign companies. The survey said that 47% of the officials felt unwelcome doing business in the country. That was an increase from 44% in the group's report last year. However, most businesses asked, 70%, said they remain profitable or very profitable. James Zimmerman is chairman of the American Chamber of Commerce in China, also known as AmCham China.
People are making money, but there's always challenges. For the last 35 years, there's been challenges here. Anyone that says there was a time when there was no challenges, or there was that golden era, forgets that there's always been challenges here.
In China, the investigation of foreign companies has become common since President Xi Jinping took power. Under his leadership, China has launched a campaign to improve food safety and against official corruption. Chinese officials have examined the operations of Microsoft, Qualcomm, Audi, McDonald's, and other foreign companies. James Zimmerman says he does not believe the government is targeting such companies on purpose. AmCham China represents more than 1,000 U.S. businesses. Its representatives often meet with U.S. and Chinese officials. Mr. Zimmerman has been working on China-related trade issues for more than 20 years. He says that he was personally involved in developing China's anti-monopoly law. He says many of the cases against foreign companies were not raised first by the government. It can be difficult for private companies to operate in China's business environment. The companies have trouble competing against state-owned businesses. The country has experienced huge changes since it moved from a planned economy to one that is more market-driven. However, the state still has a strong influence in business. The study found that 83% of those who gave answers noted concerns about the effects of internet censorship on their businesses. Mr. Zimmerman says that companies are mainly concerned about how internet controls can affect the flow of information. Those are things that affect everyone, he says. He adds that internet censorship affects some businesses more than others. However, services industries that depend on information are among the hardest hit. And that's the Economics Report from VOA. Learning English. I'm Mario Ritter.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. America's 18th president, Ulysses Grant, was elected to his second term in 1872. Grant had led the Union Army of the North to victory over the Confederate Army of the South during the Civil War. He easily won the presidency in 1868 in the first election held after the war. Now he would spend four more years as President of the United States. This week in our series, Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell about Grant's second term in office.
Grant's first administration was marked by dishonesty and shameful events. The situation grew much worse after he won a second term. Grant himself was not involved directly, but his administration suffered because of his ties to those who were involved. Soon after Grant's re-election, for example, there was a serious incident that involved many of his supporters in Congress. The Union Pacific Railroad Company had helped build a railroad across the American West to California. The cost of building the railroad was very high. The company got large amounts of aid from the government. Not all this aid came honestly. An investigation showed that leading members of Congress and even the vice president received shares of ownership in the company for free or at low cost. In exchange, they voted to use federal money to help build the railroad.
A few months later, members of Congress voted a pay raise for themselves and the executive branch of government. The pay raise would be retroactive. This meant the extra money would be paid for the 2 years already passed. Newspapers and citizens raised a storm of protest. Some lawmakers were afraid they would not be reelected, so they refused to accept the pay raise. Within 6 months, another shameful incident was uncovered. This one involved Jay Cook, one of the richest bankers in the country. He also was a good friend of President Grant. In 1869, Cook began raising money to build another railroad across America's West. He planned to sell $100 million worth of railroad bonds. Many people invested all the money they had in Cook's railroad, but Cook was unable to sell as many bonds as he expected. Soon, his banks had no money left. They could return no money to the thousands of people who had bought railroad bonds.
People hurried to other banks to withdraw their savings. Within hours, many of these other banks had to close. They, too, were out of money. Within a month, more than 5,000 banks across the country failed and closed their doors. This created an economic crisis. The New York Stock Exchange closed for 10 days. Factories closed. Thousands of people lost their jobs. Investigations showed that many of the banks that failed had violated banking laws. The laws often were not enforced because so many bankers had given money to the ruling Republican Party.
Other incidents followed. one of the biggest, was called the Whiskey Ring. It involved a group of whiskey producers and some high officials who were friends of President Grant. Together, they found a way not to pay taxes on their whiskey. One of Grant's close advisers was at the center of the incident. A grand jury found him not guilty of any crime. However, it charged several hundred whiskey producers and government officials with illegal activities. President Grant had done nothing illegal, but the Whiskey Ring incident increased public feeling that there was no honesty in the White House. The feeling grew that Grant was a failure.
These incidents took place during a time of intense social and political change in the United States. The period after the Civil War was a time of industrial revolution and business growth. Most of this growth was taking place in the North. Before the Civil War, most businesses were small. Now, there were many companies with large numbers of workers. The companies also had large numbers of owners. They sold shares of ownership to anyone with enough money to buy.
A few men rose to positions of great power in business. In the steel industry, for example, there was Andrew Carnegie. He came to the United States as a boy from Scotland. He took a low-paying job in a factory that produced cotton cloth. He worked hard. In time, he earned enough money to take control of an iron factory. Carnegie soon built another factory. This one produced steel with a new technology. The system worked well. Soon, he was earning more than $1 million a year. He competed fiercely with other steel companies. He pressured railroads to transport his steel for lower prices than his competitors. And he cut his prices to force other steelmakers out of the business. Before long, Andrew Carnegie was the unquestioned leader of America's steel industry. His position gave him great power over the economy of the whole country.
What Carnegie did for the steel industry, John D. Rockefeller did for the oil industry. Oil became a useful product only in the middle of the 1800s. Rockefeller was part of a group of businessmen who built an oil processing center in Ohio. It was so successful that Rockefeller gave up his other business interests. He put all his money into oil production. He formed the Standard Oil Company of Ohio. John D. Rockefeller's new company used the same aggressive business methods as Andrew Carnegie. Rockefeller bought control of other oil processing companies. He started price wars that forced his competitors out of business. Most important, Rockefeller made a secret deal with the railroads. The deal greatly reduced his transportation costs. This permitted him to crush his competition. Before long, he controlled 95% of the oil processing industry in the United States.
As with steel and oil, America's railroads were an extremely important business in the 1800s. In fact, they were the nation's biggest business. They were as important as automobiles and airplanes are to the American economy today. Before the Civil War, most railroads were east of the Mississippi River. Most were small lines. In the years after the war, four major railroads got control of almost all the lines in the east, and they began building new lines in the west.
The first rail line to cross the nation was completed in 1869. It was built by two companies. One company started from the east and went west. The other went in the opposite direction. Finally, after 6 years of back-breaking labor, the two work teams met in northern Utah. They connected the rail lines with a golden spike. It was a great moment in the nation's history. Now, at last, the two coasts of the United States were united by a single line of metal rail. It was like the day 100 years later when the first American walked on the moon.
Like the steel and oil industries, the railroad industry also had its stories of intense business competition. In this case, the most influential man was Cornelius Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt already was rich from the shipping industry. Now, he formed the New York Central Railroad. It was the largest railroad in the East. Cornelius Vanderbilt tried to take over the railroad industry. He was not as successful as Andrew Carnegie with steel, or John D. Rockefeller with oil. A group of other rich railroad owners blocked his plans. But Vanderbilt did succeed in winning a great amount of power and influence.
Vanderbilt and the other new leaders of industry were powerful, and they let others know it. They sometimes made statements about how they did not have to obey the law. Other powerful men thought the same way. Some were offered or appointed to serve in the federal government. Political power blinded them to their responsibility to be honest and fair to the public. As a result, the Republican Party lost public support. The blame was placed on Ulysses Grant. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs can be found, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.